I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In.
Today's guest, Ernest Scheider, is a senior correspondent for Reuters covering the green energy transition and the mining of the minerals required for its implementation. He previously covered the U.S. shale oil revolution, politics, and the environment. He is the author of the recently published book, The War Below: Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. So, Ernest, welcome to Delving In.
Hey, great to be with you, Stuart.
I also noticed that online that you won the 2021 Spirit of Maine Award. So congratulations. I'm not sure what that is, but it sounded pretty good.
Oh, thank you. I attended the University of Maine, and it's an alumni award. So I'm very flattered to get back to Maine a lot whenever I'm able to, and really enjoy growing up there and going to school there.
So you're an officially a distinguished alumnus.
That's what they tell me.
All right. So first off, I want to congratulate you on your recent book.
Thank you.
Which is chock full of engaging stories about a vitally important topic. And who knew that a book about mining minerals and fights between environmentalist and green revolution visionaries could be a real page turner? So tell us, how did you get interested in this topic to begin with, and what kept the interest going?
Yeah, so my interest initially in this topic grew out of my day job here at Reuters, where I've been writing about the critical minerals space for the past 5 or 6 years. And the more that I covered these areas, the more I saw a narrative thread emerge as part of that reporting. And Stuart, in a previous life, I used to cover the oil and gas industry. I actually lived in North Dakota for more than 2 years writing about fracking. And it's a very controversial topic. A lot of folks across the country have very strong opinions in one way or the other. But on the energy transition, I think a lot of folks in general say that, yes, we are okay with this energy transition. Sure, we need more minerals. 98-99% of the people that I would talk to in my day job at Reuters about critical minerals would just say, sure, we want more of them. The tension really was around where those projects actually got built, sort of the idea of not in my backyard. Sure, I'm all for everyone having an electric vehicle or everyone having an electronic gadget or gizmo, but I don't want a lithium mine in my backyard. I don't want nickel anywhere near me being taken out of the ground. And the more I saw opposition to projects across the country and across the world, I really saw a narrative thread emerge that became The War Below. And it's a book for everyone because I'm really firmly believe that it's a topic that matters for us all.
Yeah, and clearly both sides have a lot to say for itself. You know, both the environmentalist side that doesn't want places to be spoiled, and then the other environmental side, which is that we need to make the transition away from fossil fuels. And I was glad to see that there wasn't a war between fossil fuel advocates and renewable energy advocates. I mean, that wasn't the purpose of your book.
No, that wasn't the purpose at all. I think there have been plenty of books that have focused specifically on the petroleum industries. There's some many amazing books out there that do that. What I wanted to do here is to take this central idea of choice and bring it to the reader. The idea is that if we want an energy transition, and even beyond that, if we want all of these gadgets and gizmos that connect us every day, cell phones, laptops, etc., we have to be having a discussion about where we want to get the building blocks for those products. Electric vehicles just don't grow on trees. Cell phones don't just show up at a store. The building blocks come from somewhere. And so that was the tension that I wanted to bring here. The question of whether we have a completely dependent fossil fuel economy or a completely dependent materials economy, I think that's trodden ground in other books. What I wanted to explore here are the idea of choice and the people that are centered and affected by these choices, whether that's in Arizona, where we've got a lot of indigenous communities that oppose copper mining projects, or whether that's in northern Minnesota, where you've got a large cobalt and copper and nickel deposit that could help really boost the U.S. production of these critical minerals. Those are just two of the examples that I explore in the book. But the idea of choice really is central to this narrative. And I hope the book sparks a conversation because we have to be having this conversation.
Yeah, and clearly the book was not polemical in any way. You laid out both sides of the issues very beautifully and didn't decide for the reader gets to decide for themselves.
Right, which was my goal.
So let's give a little background here, since this is for a general audience, about the green revolution. With almost anything powered by electricity, there's a need for energy storage, whether in a cell phone or a vehicle. And in order to combat global warming, we're all expected to eventually transition to electric cars. And that's a big source of fossil fuel cars are a big source of global warming pollution. But in order to do that, the world needs to vastly increase the access to lithium and the creation of lithium batteries. But as you point out in your book, lithium batteries are made from more than just lithium. So what else is needed?
Lithium is the main component of a lithium ion battery, as of course the name suggests. You can't have it without lithium, but also depending on the chemistry of a battery, you could have cobalt or nickel. Copper would be part of it. Copper also is used widely in wiring. There is some plastic that is part of a battery, and you have other minerals in there as well. So those are the four main minerals that I explore in the book. There's also a ranking, a type of minerals known as rare earths. These are 17 minor metals that are on the periodic table of elements. And they're basically, they have a lot of wide, varied usage across the economy, but broadly, they're used to make magnets that help turn power into motion. So the thing that makes your cell phone vibrate is a rare earth magnet made from rare earths. And China right now controls about 80, 85% of that global industry. So there's a bit of a geopolitical angle to this whole topic as well.
Yeah. And as far as the other components, as you mentioned in the book, rare earths are not necessarily that rare. They're actually fairly common, but it's hard to find them in any substantial quantity in any one particular place. And so that makes it more complicated. And then there's the physical process of acquiring the stuff is very complicated. And I wasn't really that aware of what's involved, but I guess you have to pulverize the rock and then usually use acid, usually sulfuric acid, to separate, to create a chemical process that separates the metals that you need. And then you have a residue from that chemical process. And what do you do with it? It becomes a kind of sludge, and you can have a whole mountain of sludge that becomes dangerous.
Yes. Yeah. You're referring to what's known as tailings. That's the industry term for it. And mining uses a lot of water. And at the end, after you've extracted the metal that is your main target, those tailings tend to be like a muddy, goopy detritus. And think back to when you were a kid playing in maybe your backyard and you would do like mud pies. You'd mix dirt with water and then you stack them up. That's not too far off from what a tailings dam actually is. And sometimes they collapse when they get too high or if they're not monitored correctly. And we saw a few years ago, one in Brazil collapsed at an iron ore mine and it killed more than 300 people. And so this just lays bare the stark danger that is in modern mining. It has improved in terms of safety vastly the past 50 to 100 years, but it still is a pretty intense and dangerous industry. You've got used dynamite, you're moving a ton of rock, you've got giant equipment, you've got these tailings dams. It just lays bare the stark danger for the whole broad industry.
Yeah, for anyone who's watched The Crown in the third season, there was a tailings dam disaster in Aberfan, Wales, from coal mining, and the mountain of tailings collapsed and buried an elementary school with all the kids and staff inside.
Yes. Yeah, I remember watching that episode and knowing immediately what was happening as it was happening because I had just started writing for Reuters about the tailings disaster in Brazil. And so that the timing of the airing of that episode was very interesting. And I think it brought to a broader audience to the idea that these things can collapse. And it's not just in other areas of the world. It's in Western countries that they happen frequently.
Right. So that was back in 1966, but the more recent one in Brazil is 2019. That's so long ago.
Yes. Yep. Not that long ago at all.
So one of the central threads of your book, which threads the way from the beginning to the end about a giant deposit, and the examples in your book typically involve giant deposits, like world-class, huge percentage of what's needed, and whether it's lithium or copper or whatever. And this one is in the Nevada desert. And it just so happens to be the only habitat of a rare flower discovered by University of Nevada botanist Jerry Thieme. And as you write, thus the paradox, what matters more, the plant or the lithium beneath it? And it turns out this plant loves lithium-rich soil, apparently. You know, how much, it's I don't know if that's ironic or Murphy's Law or whatever, what would that be?
Certainly the company would call it a misfortune, but where we are, in the book chronicles the tension between the company and the conservation group that is hoping to protect this rare flower found nowhere else on the planet. And so the key question that I explore in the book, and I use this example of Thieme's buckwheat as the spine really for the narrative for the whole book, is this idea of choice really. Do we care if the flower goes extinct? Can the flower and the mine coexist? Should we just say we don't care what happens to the flower because we need the lithium to help fight climate change? If we did nothing to fight climate change, wouldn't the flower go extinct because the planet is slowly getting warmer? These are all sort of the tension points that I really wanted to bring to the reader and hope that she or he really grapples with the complexities of these issues, because the answers really are for us to decide collectively. Are we going to let this flower go extinct, or are we thinking that they can, that the mind and the flower can coexist? And what are the things that we want to advocate for as humans, really? The conservationists would say, if we let this flower go extinct, it's a slippery slope. Then what do we let go extinct next? And on the flip side of it, it's, you've got a very earnest mining company that says, this is the best way to help save the planet from climate change. And the leader of that company, or the chairman, excuse me, is someone who I chronicle in depth in the book, who used to be in the oil and gas industry, and he sees his work in lithium as his way to help leave the planet cleaner for his children and grandchildren than the one that he found. So there's almost a moral imperative from where he's coming from here to be able to produce and process this lithium. So therein lies the tension that's really at the heart of the narrative here in The War Below, is this matter of choice bringing to the reader and saying, okay, what matters more? And you get to know both people on both sides of this issue and what makes them tick as part of the narrative. And I'm excited for readers to decide for themselves what they want to do.
Yeah, clearly this is a situation of right versus right rather than right versus wrong. And the question is, which right is more important than the other right? And do you have a, you didn't mention this in the book, but do you have a sense of what the public opinion would be about something like Team's buckwheat?
So this is a site that's about 200 miles north of Las Vegas. It's in literally the middle of nowhere. It's actually hard to find the site if you don't know where you're looking. And so it tends to be out of sight, out of mind for many people. You don't show up to your local greenhouse and buy a Team's buckwheat, for instance. It very much only likes that part, that soil there. So it's unclear to right now what the broader public opinion would be on this. But the issue of biodiversity versus climate change is a topic that we explore in the book right now. And increasingly, you're having voices talk about the importance of biodiversity for our planet's survival. And so if we're going to let one species go extinct, what does that mean about our approach to biodiversity as a whole? So in that regard, we do tend to see some voices being raised around this topic.
Right. But I get the sense that the voices are mainly people who are already active in let's say, an environmental movement one way or the other, rather than the general public. I get the sense that the general public is, at least until your book, is fairly oblivious to the whole thing.
People that are not oblivious are policymakers in Washington who have been grappling with this issue very closely, even before the Biden administration, the Trump administration as well. So it is front of mind for policymakers. The book does explore how different policymakers in Washington have taken different approaches to this issue. And that's maybe something we could talk about later in the conversation. But the topic does have the attention of policymakers. And I would say that for a certain amount of the populace, that they are interested in this topic. But again, it gets to the broader theme of what matters more and can things coexist. And I think people broadly are interested in those themes.
There's another ethical dilemma that you bring up very beautifully in the book, and that's that the developed world is using most of these minerals. We tend to use more energy and so more renewable energy and so on and so forth. And yet we don't seem to be willing to have to take the risk, the environmental risks of mining these things on our own soil, at least not for a while. Certainly in the past, we've mined a lot of coal and copper, and pretty close to where I live in the Silver City, which is actually mostly was copper mining. But there are other places in the underdeveloped world, Central Africa, for instance, the cobalt mines in Congo, where we're taking advantage of their willingness to do cheap labor, unsafe working conditions, little or no environmental protections. And then also in China, the up-and-coming country also has very little regard for these other things that we would have. So mining it in our own country seems to be ethically important. On the other hand, it's super difficult to do because of all the regulations.
Stuart, I think you just hit the nail on the head there. That is one of the main tension points that I push into here on the book as well. If we want these modern electronics and these modern devices to help fight climate change, are we comfortable with the building blocks for those products being, not to put too fine a point on it, but being taken out of the ground by a 7-year-old in the Congo? This is an actual situation happening now. You have children, part of the mining supply chain in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which has the world's largest supplies of cobalt. And it can be impossible to track that cobalt once it goes into the global supply chain, even though many manufacturers have been very ardent about trying to stop it. Meanwhile, you've got large cobalt deposits here in the United States that, for various reasons, have faced legitimate opposition, and some of which have been put on ice right now. And so that main tension point you hear from politicians, investors, and others is, why would we let the supply chain as it is right now exist or continue to exist when we know that it deploys child labor or might tear up a rainforest or might have production methods that would not fly in the United States or other Western nations. That's part of the tension right now as well. And I got to say, I don't think we're having that conversation. We're not really thinking through where the building blocks come from our everyday lives. I think the pandemic started that conversation. It was roughly 4 years ago this month, Stuart, that we all discovered that the United States didn't make any masks. Just as the pandemic was starting, this most basic yet necessary piece of medical equipment we realized was not made in the United States. And I think that sort of got people's attention, and perhaps more so than in the past, on this idea of where our stuff comes from that we use every single day. And I think with this energy transition, we have to be having that conversation, but just on steroids here. We have to be thinking about where these building blocks come from. We started to have it a little bit around clothing, for instance. A few years ago, there was a big fire at a warehouse in Bangladesh, and people realized that there were sweatshops, basically, that were making the clothing that you and I buy every day for very popular brands. And so I think that sparked outrage over why some of these brands were basically paying pennies, the equivalent of pennies, to these workers working in atrocious conditions. Now you sort of just magnify that onto the global supply chain for critical minerals, which are vastly more important than clothing. And I think you realize that the issue here is of much, much bigger significance. And it's going to have to take an informed populace that demands higher standards for these critical minerals and says that if we, especially when it comes to climate change, if we think these devices are so important for climate change, solar panels, wind turbines, electric vehicles, how they're built matters, especially if we want to save the planet.
Yeah, I would think that some people might be reluctant to pay more money to, if the things that we get are both manufactured and sourced in a more ethical way elsewhere. If the whole world had better environmental standards and labor standards, everything would become more expensive. I would be all for that. I don't know if the average American would be. I don't know.
No, you've hit the nail on the head as well. It's people shop for many reasons, right? But the main motivating factor when people shop does tend to be price. There's just no way around that. And we saw that when the globalization trend took off in the 1980s and 1990s and early 2000s, that really became the main focus for a lot of corporations, price, which is why we saw a lot of manufacturing leave the United States and go to other countries. But I think you're starting to see, especially after the pandemic, a focus more on regionalization for more security reasons, as well as climate change abatement reasons. You know, you emit fewer emissions when you have production closer to home, to where an item is consumed. It's obviously cheaper, and you have more security that that product cannot be interrupted by a weather event or some other event. So I think you're starting to see that slowly become more part of the conversation.
Yeah, and as you write, the United States is expected to produce just 3% of the world's annual lithium needs by 2030, even though it holds about 24% of the world's lithium reserves. So we're not doing our part, so to speak.
And the thing about critical minerals is they can be recycled. Oil and natural gas is burned off and it's gone forever. But just because it's in the ground, you know, and you take it out, doesn't mean that you use it one and you're done. You can continually reuse it over and over again as part of a recycling effort. And there are some efforts across the United States right now to increase domestic lithium production. We'll just take lithium in this example. I was last month at a conference in Little Rock, Arkansas, where the state is firmly supporting plans by ExxonMobil and Albemarle and others to increase lithium production there in that state, or to even begin lithium production, I should say. And that just shows the stark interest in the United States, at least, for boosting lithium production. And I got to tell you, Stuart, I've been covering lithium 5 or 6 years. I never expected to be at a conference in Little Rock, Arkansas, talking about lithium. And yet it was 700 people, standing room only. The fire marshal had to turn people away at the doors. It was just fascinating, the attention in this one U.S. state on lithium production. So there's a lot of eyeballs on this space right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the regulations, the regulatory environment in the United States. What would be an example of some of the more difficult regulations that maybe we have and other places don't have, but more importantly, create a kind of a roadblock to get around or to negotiate with? At least what I gather from your book, they're difficult to comply with and create delays in the actual starting of a mine.
Yeah. So the United States has had a mining law on the books since 1872, and this 1872 law governs most mining in the Western United States, and it was designed to help increase the population in what was then a pretty remote area. In the years after the U.S. Civil War, Washington wanted to basically encourage people to move west. And so that law had in it a lot of carrots, if you will. One of the biggest ones was if you take minerals out of the ground and that ground is owned by the federal government, you don't have to pay royalties. So it's a huge benefit to the mining industry. Now, fast forward to here we are in 2024, there are a lot of well-intentioned rules focused on environmental standards, as well as other standards out there. And what you have is a complex web of regulations that can be very confusing for both the mining industry and its opponents to try to basically figure out. And I chronicle in the book, In the War Below, several projects that have been on the drawing board for more than a decade, and they don't have any idea when they're going to get to a firm yes or a firm no. And that is perplexing, I think, for many of the people that try to advance these projects. And so the number one request that I heard time and time again when I was writing this book was a request for clarity from regulators on what is the path for a permitting process and how you can get to a yes or a no. Stuart, let's just take a hypothetical. Let's just say you owned 1,000 acres in New Mexico and you wanted to mine copper on it. You were convinced that you had a huge copper deposit there. What's the process to start getting a mining permit? Who would you talk to? Where would you go? It's so confusing and opaque right now. And the process requires hiring an army of lawyers and figuring out which agency in the federal government you have to talk to and which one you don't need to talk to. And it's this complex web, as I was saying, around where to go. And so having clarity on purpose, clarity on where the laws want you to go and don't want you to go is the number one thing I heard time and time again from so, so many voices out there as well.
And then, of course, if you have objections from the community or from environmentalists, then you have to negotiate that.
Correct. Yeah. The community relations is hugely important. And I think it's a muscle that even the mining industry would admit historically it has not done a very good job at exercising. And so in the past 5, 10, 15 years, you've started to see some mining companies really focus hardcore on community outreach, getting that community engagement, especially among First Nations and Indigenous populations, to ensure that you have free, prior, and informed consent from them, and to bring them along on the process and to talk to them about the entire scope of the project.
Yeah, speaking of Indigenous peoples, you mentioned the San Carlos Reservation. I happen to have just driven through it recently on the way back from Phoenix to Las Cruces. There's an alternate way to go that avoids Tucson, and I had never heard of it before, but it's this really gorgeous, remote, desolate, very beautiful.
It's a beautiful place. Yes.
There are roads that go through canyons, and it was really interesting to hear. And then that's, I think, if I remember right, there's a copper mine that could or might or someday could happen. But there's a lot of resistance understandably by the Native Americans on the reservation because of what it will do. And hear about environmental risks of oil wells. But one thing I wasn't quite aware of, and it's again this kind of tailings issue, is that there's a lot of danger to the water sources because of the use of chemicals and sulfuric acid and the byproducts. They can leach into the groundwater.
Yes, and there are multiple regulations to curb that or try to contain that. But yes, mining does involve gargantuan amounts of water as well as other chemicals that need to be used for the process. And there's no way around it, right? Mining is an intrusive industry. You dig a hole in the ground or underground. You have a giant tailings pit, basically, or tailings facility that stores a lot of this detritus. You do use chemicals as part of the extraction process. And so there is going to be an effect for each mine. And that depends, of course, on the design. And so right now in Arizona, you've got this big fight, as you were mentioning, between the San Carlos Apache and Rio Tinto and BHP, two large mining companies, over this project right now. And it tends to be a bit of a complex case, but at its core, it centers on the idea of Indigenous rights versus the energy transition. What matters more here? Like with the team's buckwheat, what matters more here? The Indigenous and religious rights of the San Carlos Apache people or the need for this giant copper deposit to be developed? And this would supply more than 25% of the United States' copper needs, just this one mine. So that goes to show you this sheer immense potential there if this is actually developed. But the project has been strongly opposed by the Apache, who say that if you destroy the site where they worship their deities, then they won't have a space to worship at all. And so that therein lies a lot of the complexity on the case. We mentioned water. I don't get to tell you and your listeners, of course, the Southwest has been in a drought for many years, and copper mining uses a lot of water. And what I found interesting when I was reporting out the book is I spent time in the Southwest as well as Minnesota. The Southwest, as you mentioned, obviously very arid. Minnesota has a lot of water. It's on the Great Lakes. And people in Minnesota were saying, why do you want to put a copper mine here? There's so much water. If there was an accident or a spill with some of these chemicals, you could pollute the Great Lakes and all these waterways. Don't have it here. Put it in the Southwest where there is no water. And it'll be, if there's a spill, it won't affect anything. And of course, people in the Southwest say, you need a lot of water to mine. So why would you put a mine here? Put it up in Minnesota where there's a lot of water. And so I found that comical on some level, that people in each state, in each region, basically were pointing the finger at the other region and say, go there.
Yeah, which is where I think science fiction tends to go, to asteroids or the moon.
Yeah, exactly.
Not worry about polluting something that's not on the Earth. Yeah. So you quote Michael Kowalski as saying there are certain places where mines should just never be built. And he mentions Bristol Bay in Alaska as one of the examples. And again, it's this water situation. And another example, the Boundary Waters Wilderness Area between northern Minnesota and Canada. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous remote wilderness. And if things got out of hand, it could destroy just a jewel.
That is the concern from the conservationists, of course, that these could be destroyed. And that brings up a broader question, Stuart, around what are the standards by which we as Americans, we as just humans, want mining companies to operate? And you mentioned Michael Kowalski. Kowalski used to be the CEO of Tiffany & Company, the iconic jeweler. And I chronicle in the book how he helped form this nonprofit known as the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, or IRMA. And IRMA, basically, it had a goal of setting mining standards, and it had a goal of getting all of different parties in the same room to say what is the best way to form a mine. So they got mining companies in the same room with environmentalists, with labor unions, with NGOs, with indigenous groups, with investors. And if it sounds like all of those would be at odds with each other, I thought that they would be. I was like, how are these people going to set mining standards? But they did. It took them about a decade. And now they're slowly being seen as the best way for the mining industry to be led to transparency. And so IRMA audits mines all across the world. And you've got companies like Ford and BMW and Tesla and others saying they'll only buy metals from IRMA audited mines. And this is bringing a huge amount of transparency. And it's saying, this is the acceptable level of wastewater discharge that we'll allow. Here are the chemicals that are okay. Here's what you need to be telling local populations. So when you have sensitive ecosystems like Bristol Bay or in the Boundary Waters, you can have IRMA standards to bring transparency to how that mine should be operated. And I think consumers are going to increasingly want to have more of this information, especially if we're saying that you're buying a green product. They're going to want to know that the product that they're buying actually is green.
And I think there'll be some trust issues here, because the fossil fuel industry has not exactly always been transparent about the level of risk of oil spills. I mean, there have been just horrendous oil spills, whether in the Gulf of Mexico or off Santa Barbara. It seems like there have been oil spills everywhere.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
And can we really trust industry to not underestimate or even deliberately underestimate the risks?
Yes. You're right. There have been a lot of unfortunate oil spills and a lot of unfortunate accidents in the mining industry as well. It is an intrusive, they're both intrusive industries. And I think the main message that I heard time and time again when I was reporting out The War Below and writing it was that people want more transparency from the mining industry, and they want more certainty on where plans are going. And transparency can be achieved, but it's hard to give certainty for a project, because projects can be affected by any number of things, weather, global economics, but the industry is slowly moving towards more transparency, and things like IRMA help move the ball forward.
And the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, created in 1970 by Richard Nixon.
Yes, a Republican.
Yeah. You know, ever since that's been around, we have, I guess, people who are concerned about the environment have an agency to turn to. And as long as that agency doesn't get co-opted, there's a kind of a counterbalance to the power of industry.
You mean the EPA does have very firm standards and that don't exist in other countries. And so I would say that certainly we probably would not think it's wise to have radioactive spills related to a mine site or whatever. And the EPA helps oversee those, and I think does a huge benefit to the population.
So I was really struck in your book by your description of Deep Green Resistance, an organization that is advocating the turning back of the clock, that their conviction is that the whole industrialization and modernization process has been a disaster, and it will continue to be a disaster. And even if we go to green technologies, that's going to involve other environmental disasters. We really need to turn back the clock, deindustrialize, go back to an agrarian way of life, and forget all this modernity stuff. No cell phones, no TVs, no cars. Just go way back.
Yes, indeed.
It's interesting that you included that, because it just seems like it just would be something that would be dismissed by most Americans. And yet there are people who feel that way. And I have a little bit of sympathy for that, not a lot, because I don't think it's realistic. It's as if it's been a tragic flaw in humanity to want to progress. And we're progressing ourselves maybe into extinction. It's not so good.
I hear you, Stuart, when you say that definitely it's not an idea or philosophy shared by many Americans. But I was intrigued by this philosophy and the growing interest, however small the percentage might be, across some Americans for this approach. And the main catalyst or main person that really brought this to me was a guy named Max Wilbert, who I profile in The War Below. He actually is a strong opponent of the Thacker Pass lithium mine, which is on the Nevada-Oregon border. And he joined with a local indigenous community to fight this project. And in the book, I go up as part of the reporting to the site with him and actually walk around the site and camped out there with him and got to see the site through his eyes. And his fight against this project was profiled on the front page of the New York Times. And Bill McKibben in the New Yorker praised the cause for which Max Wilbert and Deep Green Resistance were advocating for. And so it got a lot of attention there. And so I really wanted to understand what made him and his organization tick. And so I got the chance to, as I say, go up there and really profile him and bring this idea to the reader. It's like, okay, if we're not going to think through this idea of choice, where we actually want to get these building blocks, then is the alternative just not having any of this stuff? Is the alternative going back to that agrarian way of life and growing our own food in the backyard and hunting? And what does that look like? And in terms of things like when a pandemic happens, fewer medicines, things like this, shorter lifespan, more disease, potentially. I wanted to bring that idea to the reader because while it might seem far-fetched on the surface, it is a potential outcome if we don't grapple with these choices out there right now, or if we make no choice, which is in and of itself a decision. No action is a decision in and of itself. And so his ideas might seem fringe, but they're not fringe to a certain subset of the population. And I think increasingly they're becoming mainstream and we have to grapple with them. So if we don't want to mine in our backyard, are we then going to be comfortable not having cars or cell phones and growing corn and cucumbers in our backyard?
Yes, so I think the catchword for all this is sustainability. Is our current way of life sustainable or not? And I guess most people are hoping that it is, but we haven't done such a great job of making it sustainable. One of the things you mentioned earlier is recycling. It turns out that lithium and other metals are far more recyclable than they are recyclable, whereas fossil fuels get burned and they're not. And so that's a huge difference. And if we could recycle nearly all of what we use, we wouldn't need to do so much mining.
Yes and no. You're talking about the idea of getting to a circular economy, the idea that at some point in the future, we're going to be able to recycle every device at the end of its life, old cell phones, old electric vehicles, old laptops, take out all the metals inside and use them to make new metals. When we're actually going to hit that tipping point, I don't know. And I think anybody that says that they know doesn't actually speak with certainty. Some say maybe 2050, maybe 2060. All I know is that when you look at the sheer demand projections for lithium, copper, nickel, cobalt, and many other critical minerals, you're seeing 100, in some cases, 1,000 percentage increase in demand over the next 10 years. And that can only come from virgin mining or sort of new mines, new holes dug in the ground, if you'll forgive the vernacular. And so the mining industry itself actually realizes this. They recognize that their business model has to change just way out in the future. Like a great example is Albemarle, world's largest lithium company, and it processes lithium primarily in China right now, but also other parts of the world. It's headquartered in North Carolina and had announced plans to build a giant lithium refinery in South Carolina. And the company was mainly going to take lithium from elsewhere in the world, Australia and Chile, and maybe a project it might develop in the United States and process it there. But they also said a certain percentage of that plant is going to be earmarked for recycling in the future. They weren't exactly sure how that would work or what that would look like. This is what they said publicly, but they were saying that part of that plant will be earmarked for lithium recycling in the future. So I think you're starting to see the industry recognize that. In the book, I chronicle how one mining CEO who operated a mine in South America said that he thought that there would, at some point, there would be a last mine dug. When that would happen, he had no clue, but he'd think that there will be a point where we get to there where we have the last mine dug. And so I'm fascinated by this idea of the circular economy. And in the book, I explore how Apple and other companies are trying to basically get rid of the modern mining industry as we know it. Apple, of course, has a lot of money at its disposal, so it can perhaps make choices that others might not be able to make. But there is a movement in that direction. There's also a logistical problem, though, with recycling in general. When you have a lot of old batteries, they can explode because batteries obviously hold a charge. And so there's a risk to transporting them. And actually, the number one cost right now in the recycling industry is transporting old batteries. And so having more recycling facilities closer to population centers probably is the way to go. But there again, you're building another industrial facility that aren't always as popular. And so navigating that legal minefield and just political and social minefield is another thing for this industry to contend with. But there's just no way around the fact that for the foreseeable future, we're going to need more mines to increase the supply of metals in global circulation so that when we do hit that tipping point on a circular economy, we can actually fully go circular.
So it's not around the corner, but it's theoretically possible in the future, in another couple of decades maybe. So you also mentioned another form of, I don't know if it's even called mining, but another way of accessing lithium that doesn't involve digging. And that was really interesting. One of the places for this was the Salton Sea. It tends to be lakes of brine that are just below salt flats. There's one in Bolivia, a huge one in Bolivia, and the Salton Sea, which I happened to pass by. I took a train to Santa Barbara several years ago, and I happened to be awake at 4 a.m. and I noticed we were passing by the Salton Sea. What is that? I never heard of this place. It's huge. At least in one dimension, it's huge. And then finding out a little bit about it and finding out a lot more about it in your book. So tell us about Salton Sea and also the salt flats of Bolivia and how that figures into a different way of acquiring lithium.
Yeah, first off, I got to just take a step back and just say right now, there are two main ways to produce lithium, either from hard rock mines, what people think of when they think of mining, like putting a hole in the ground, or taking brine. Brine is basically salty water that can be in a lot of deposits across the world. And you can pump it out of the ground and put it in giant evaporation ponds that are hundreds of acres in size. And through a series of chemical reactions across several evaporation ponds, you can basically remove lithium and any other minerals that might be in that brine. And then you pump it back underground in some cases. That's the two most common ways to produce lithium right now. But the holy grail, if you will, for the lithium industry in recent years has been what's called direct lithium extraction. That is, can you take that brine that comes from underground reservoirs, and can you put it through a machine where you're just filtering out the lithium and leaving all the other minerals and the water alone? And lithium is a salt, and so it can be pretty hard to do that. The process has never worked independently at commercial scale without evaporation ponds. And so for a while, it had been a bit of a science experiment. Companies like Dow Chemical and others were successful on the lab scale about 40, 50 years ago, direct lithium extraction, but the hunt to actually take it commercial had never really reached a fever pitch until recently, because what did we have recently? We had the dawn of the electric vehicle revolution, and so you saw demand for lithium spike. And so in the book, I chronicle how the early version of DLE was invented by a scientist at Dow Chemical, and went through the back and forth with him there. There's also some juicy bits on Elon Musk and how he basically walked away from a core bit of direct lithium extraction technology. And I also traveled to Bolivia, which has the world's largest resource for lithium and has been trying to find the right technology company, the right direct lithium extraction technology company to help it produce and process this lithium there. And so we get to follow one DLE company as he goes through parts of Bolivia and tries to basically win the social license to operate to bring his company there. But at its core, DLE works, a great analog is a household water softener. Some houses have them, and to remove iron or other heavy metals from drinking water. A direct lithium extraction device basically works to try to remove that lithium and nothing else. And then you can re-inject that brine back underground. Companies like ExxonMobil are joining the race right now. Exxon has spent more than $100 million betting that it can produce lithium in Arkansas, of all places, using direct lithium extraction technology. And so there's a huge focus on this. And as you were saying, Stuart, the promise or the appeal is you wouldn't have to have an open pit mine anymore, and you wouldn't need to have these giant evaporation ponds that are hundreds of acres in size and can waste water. But you got to get the technology to work, and it hasn't quite worked yet on a commercial scale. I think someone will at some point basically be able to do that. And I chronicle in the book some people that feel like they could be first, and also some parts of the world that feel like they could be first. But to me, it was an interesting area to explore because I think technology is one of the answers here to our need for more critical minerals. And DLE, I think, will go a long way to helping advance that.
Yeah, one of the characters, I should just say people, not character. Some of it reads like a novel, so I say character. One of the people you profile is Teague Egan of DLE. And it's so interesting to read about the way you profile him. It sounds like he's just full of bravado, this entrepreneur is promising the sky when he doesn't really have all the technology completely down yet. He's promising Bolivia that, oh, we can do it. DLA is going to do it. And then they're asking him to demonstrate the process. And, well, okay, they're a little bit late with it. So it just seems like all the different players are promising the sky. And Bolivia is supposed to accept that this company or that company is capable of doing it. And the enormous amounts of money involved, and billions of dollars, for something that's not a sure thing. But the potential rewards are so enormous that people will do it anyway.
Yes, the linchpin for Bolivia is the resource that it controls, which is this giant lithium deposit underneath Salar de Uyuni, which is visible from outer space. It's so huge. It's bigger than the Big Island of Hawaii. And all that lithium underneath there can be produced, in theory, with the right technology. And company that the one T. Egan runs and others have been fighting vociferously for the right to do this. And I won't spoil anything for the reader. I'll let her or him decide for themselves. But yeah, you get to track T. Egan as he goes throughout different cities in Bolivia and makes his pitch to Bolivian authorities for why they should give his company this lithium contract.
Okay, so we're not going to give a spoiler as to whether he gets the contract, huh?
No spoilers here.
But it is amazing that you have these high-powered players putting down these incredible offers. And at the very last minute, I'm not talking about this one necessarily, the offer seems to be accepted by the buyer, so to speak. And then at the last minute, maybe not, and no explanation. And it's just so much money involved. It's just mind-bogglingly expensive. But mind-bogglingly rewarding, actually, more than expensive. It's expensive to do it, but the rewards are vastly greater than what you would expend. This is like probably one of the most profitable things you could possibly do if you can get the contract.
Yeah, and I think, Stuart, you just hit your nail on the head when you say profitable. I think host governments across the world are increasingly realizing that if they have large deposits of these critical minerals within their borders, they're in the driver's seat in a way that perhaps they hadn't been 50, 60 years ago. Because whoever controls lithium and copper and nickel and cobalt is going to control the 21st century economy the way that crude oil control dominated the 20th century economy. And so this idea of resource nationalism really is coming to the fore now. We're seeing countries saying, hey, we've got this lithium or copper or whatever within our borders. And so we're not necessarily just going to take it out of the ground and ship it somewhere else to be turned into an electric vehicle. We want you to put battery production here or cathode production here, or we want your electric vehicle company to build a plant here. And that is increasingly the ask. Bolivia, for instance, has very bold, aggressive plans to develop its own electric vehicle industry. Now, how practical that is, I don't know. Take, for instance, the United States, which doesn't right now produce any cathodes at all. A cathode is part of a battery. You have a cathode and an anode. And the United States itself does not produce any right now. It, of course, would like to make more of its own. It would like to basically build up its own electric vehicle industry. But if the United States doesn't produce cathodes right now, the efforts to attract industry to Bolivia to do that are perhaps a taller order. But they have the lithium there. And so they have a lot of ability to say, if you want the lithium here, you got to be able to build a whole supply chain here. And they are sitting in the driver's seat.
Right, and they just need to have the best engineers to help them do it, whether Bolivian engineers or foreign engineers that come to Bolivia. But meanwhile, it seems like China has a head start on just about everything, and not just the minerals within China, but they're contracting with countries all over the world. And they seem to be, because of they have a track record, they seem to be winning a lot of the contracts.
Yes, China realized, I think, perhaps quicker than other countries across the world, that critical minerals were a huge leverage point and that the global economy was moving in this direction. And so it has basically cornered control of many of these industries in the past 20 or 30 years. And it has begun to use them as economic weapons. We mentioned rare earths earlier in the conversation. China is now the world's largest rare earths producer. And that's because the US basically let it happen. The US was the world's largest rare earths producer, but rare earths can be a bit of an environmental mess to produce in some cases. And so that has spurned the ire of the EPA and other agencies that we were discussing. And some of the mines in the United States that produced rare earths got a lot of fines from the EPA. And one in particular that I profile on the book in Southern California went bankrupt. Its owner went bankrupt a few times due in part to those fines. Meanwhile, China has one of the world's largest rare earth mines, and its ESG standards are different than we would allow in the United States. There is a rare earth mine that has a tailings waste pit larger than Central Park, New York City's Central Park, which is just mind-boggling when you think about it. That would never fly in the United States. But I argue in the book, and do argue here now, that part of the reason China's economy is the second largest in the world is because of its control of the rare earth space. These are used all across the global economy. And China has moved in the past to limit exports. In 2010, it had a diplomatic spat with Japan, and so it blocked exports of rare earths to Tokyo. This went huge red flags all across Japan. And so basically the Japanese government started scouring the world for non-Chinese supply, and it didn't really have many options. And that's just one example right there. So just think about if supply from Asia were interrupted to the United States due to weather or some other event, then you really start to see that relying on one part of the world for many crucial products maybe isn't the smartest move.
And particularly reliability of China, which has become our chief rival economically and maybe militarily too. It can be a scary scenario.
It does lay bare the tension, as you say.
So I'm wondering, with the remaining time, about 10 minutes or so, if we could talk about your writing process and your information gathering process. It sounds really interesting, getting to know all these major players of various sides and going to places all around the world where these things are happening, and sometimes on mountain roads with cliffs off the sides.
I survived, I should say.
Yes, I can see that.
I wanted to really humanize all people here on this story. And so it was important for me to meet everyone in person and to really figure out what made her or him tick. And I think too often, especially in our current political discourse, it's very easy to otherize somebody and say, oh, that's on the other side of the issue, or I don't know that person, or I don't really care about them, or they're just evil. And I really wanted to help present to the reader who these people are, all 360 degrees of them, so that the reader could determine what they think, really, of these complex issues and the people behind them. Because human beings are complex, and they have many motivating factors buried deep within them. And when it comes to an issue like the energy transition and critical minerals, which can be a rather complex space, using human stories is the best way to explain for the reader these areas. And I really thrive in my writing process on explaining complex areas in basic English, basic language, to help people understand them. So that's really been the hallmark of my journalism career. And I wanted the book to take that same approach as well, because this can be a complex area, but I wanted people to understand why it matters to them and why they should care about it. This is not a book written for geologists or investors. It's a book written for everyone, because I firmly believe that this is a topic that matters to everyone. So by bringing the stories of these people on all sides of these issues, I really wanted the reader to determine, okay, what are the issues that I should be grappling with here? And if I've taken one thing away from writing this book, Stuart, it's that I firmly feel that an author gets to ask one question of the audience. And the question that I'm asking here is, what are the choices we're willing to make? I'm saying you have to be grappling with these choices. We can't put our heads in the sand anymore and not decide what we want as Americans, as humans, just in general. we have to be having this internal argument here. And so I'm not saying one way or the other if we should have minds here or there or not have minds in certain places. What I am saying is that we have to be having a discussion about what are the choices we're willing to make. We're not having those discussions anymore. And we didn't have those 100, 150 years ago when the petroleum-based economy took off. And what did we get out of that? We got armed conflict. We had wars in the 20th century over oil. We got climate change. We got a giant cartel in OPEC that controls a huge chunk of the world's oil production. And if we're not careful, we're going to have some of the same mistakes made on this critical minerals transition that's happening right now. So I really want us to be thinking about where we want to get the building blocks for our everyday lives. And that's why the writing here for me was just so important to focus on the people, because I think that humanizes it and brings it to a level that we can all appreciate and digest together.
Yeah, I agree. And it's one of the things that makes your book so readable, is because it is about real people. And I would imagine that your hope would be that not just the general reader, but also politicians who make decisions would read this book. Maybe it even could be required reading. I don't know which environmental committee there is in the Congress, but is there such a committee? There ought to be.
Yes, there is. I was very happy that I had bipartisan support for the book. Representative Eric Swalwell is a big fan, as is Swalwell is a Democrat, as is Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican, and both have read the book and enjoyed it. And for me, it was great to see their reaction to this, because I agree with you. I think this is a book that should be read by policymakers in Washington, D.C. to really grapple with what their constituents are saying and thinking about these complex areas.
And certainly your own politics stay out of the book. I didn't get any hint whatsoever one way or the other.
Which was a conscious choice, Stuart, actually. Others might have taken a different approach to writing it, but for me, it was extremely important to remove myself. I am a character in the book only so far as I physically go to the place and explain what I see. But it was important for me to remove myself, to remove my opinions, if you will, here, and to let the reader determine for her or himself. A great parallel is when I covered the oil and gas industry, I had to get a lot of questions from people that would ask me, fracking, good or bad? And I would say, I don't know, you're drinking out of a plastic cup, you're wearing a polyester shirt, you took a taxi here powered by gasoline, you tell me fracking good or bad. And these are just complex issues. And I think the same questions can be circumposed onto the critical mineral space. Open pit mining, good or bad? I don't know. Let's think through what would happen if we didn't have open pit mining. What are the choices we're willing to make? These are the complexities that I really hope we think through more, because the issues aren't just so black and white and we have to be grappling with them. It's about much more than what I think. But what I am saying is, and I firmly believe this, is that we have to be having this debate, this argument, this wrestle around what we want to do. I mean, inaction, indecision is not an option anymore.
It seems like you've practiced long and hard to be neutral about what you report on, just to try to delve in, to use the name of the show, and learn as much as you can. And you and I have something in common in a way, because you treat your material the way, as a psychologist, I'm a retired psychologist, you have to talk to people without judging them in both cases. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to help. And you're not helping the people you're talking to, but you're helping the reader to figure things out and to have the information with which to decide, good quality and well thought out and nuanced information.
Yes, I agree. But that's what people want at the end of the day. And especially when you have such a complex area as the energy transition. Stuart, you and I just spent 10 minutes talking about tailings dams. That's not normal conversation, but it's important because these are such a huge part of the energy production process nowadays. And so people need to be understanding them. And so helping people understand the complexities of these issues, but in a human-focused and human-first way, I think is crucial. And that's why I wrote The War Below with that idea in mind.
So do you think your next project is going to be more of the same, but in a different slant, or will it be something completely new?
Oh, gosh. One book at a time, Stuart. One book at a time.
I should let you rest a little bit first.
But I tell you, I'd love to come back on the show when I get there and talk about book number two when we get there, though.
All right. No, I'm just curious, though, that if you had a specific interest that you might pursue, or there's enough here And certainly as the industry develops, the new nuances, new wrinkles will emerge, I imagine.
I'm excited for just broadly where the energy transition is going. I think it's going to completely revamp how we think about energy in the 21st century. I think the potentials are enormous. And I think as a journalist, there's going to be a lot of fascinating areas to cover. And yeah, I'm excited. I love technology. I love big societal change. I love writing about people. And I think the energy transition includes all of those.
And it does seem that there's an urgency here. These technologies, if they're going to develop, they need to be developed pretty soon if we have any chance of holding back climate change to a survivable degree. And I don't personally think that we're going to all go extinct, but I think that the level of harm and the level of political upheaval is going to be enormous.
There's definitely going to be change. And to your point that I keep saying the idea of choice because it is such a key part of my book here and the thesis. It's the indecision or inaction is also a choice. And so if we don't want to talk about where we're going to get this stuff, then okay, then we have to be comfortable with it coming from the other side of the world. And I would say just in the time we have remaining is this is about so much more than electric vehicles. I have a chapter in the book that talks about leaf blowers. And I did that on purpose because it might seem like a basic whimsy household appliance because it is, but I wanted to explain and show the reader that the transition involves so much more than transportation. Leaf blowers, as we know them, tend to be powered by two-stroke engines, which are horrible for the environment. They spew out all these noxious pollutants, and they're just horrible for the environment. And so you started to see a lot of electric leaf blowers take off. And so a few years ago, I got a house and I got a backyard, and I decided I'll get an electric leaf blower. But I was just starting to write this book, and it really took me down the rabbit hole of, okay, where did the metals inside this electric leaf blower come from? And I couldn't figure out where they came from. And I got a lot of resources at my disposal, Stuart, but I couldn't figure it out. And so that's just one leaf blower. Now think about all these other devices that are powered by lithium ion batteries that we use every single day. And it really crystallizes the importance of security and supply chain, transparency, understanding where this stuff comes from, and helping consumers make informed decisions about how they buy the products that they use every single day.
Yeah, electric things in general is the wave of the future for sure, whether it's appliances or vehicles or battery storage. If you have solar energy, solar panels on your roof, if you want to get off the grid, you have to have batteries. So it's really going to be ubiquitous.
Even how we're talking right now, microphones over a distance, there's all these critical minerals that go into them.
Yeah, and as you point out in the book, copper is needed in far greater quantities for electric things than fossil fuel driven things.
Yes, exactly.
So, this has been really wonderful. Ernest Scheider, a senior correspondent for Reuters, covering the green energy transition and the mining of the minerals required for its implementation, and the author of the recently published book, The War Below, Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. Thank you so much for coming on to Delving In.
Hey, great to be with you.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.